Isn't today great? Today is such a great day. Everything is so great.
We're going to have a lot of fun. We got some wonderful people for you.
All you mommies and daddies out there who complain to the radio station, I got something to say to you.
And the first thing you've got to do is say the call letters properly. Okay?
It's an incredible metamorphosis of love and emotion and sensitivity and tenderness and fun and joy and happiness.
Did you know that this show represents health and hope?
It's a great day for lively conversation on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Yeah, we'll take on that cultural cacophony. I know you have a lot to say about a lot of things. We'll do it as time permits. And we'll talk about race and social change, one of the big parts of our national conversation that I know a lot of folks feel pessimistic about. But we'll talk with an educator and author, Max Clow, who has some other views. You might not feel so pessimistic when we're done. We'll see. And we'll get you in the mix, too. You're listening live. It is Friday, April 12th. It's 12 noon out west, 2 p.m. Central, 3 o'clock here in the east. Our number in motion, 347-857-4505. You know, Twitter's 24/7, so jump in when it works for you live or on podcast at AB Writes. If you're joining us for the live broadcast, more and more folks are doing it, and we love it. Avail yourself of the entire social media platforms, along with the aforementioned. We have the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box open. It's all being held by our talented, tenacious TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora there in the booth. ML at headquarters. The show is brought to you in part today by Audiophile, from music to books to podcasts. Caress your ears with everything you want to hear from Audiophile. By Panera, the way food should be, now delivered, and by our pals at PopNet. It's arts, culture, and conversation on air, online, up and running 24/7, and featuring select editions of the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show and those robust, dare we say, occasionally raucous roundtables. So let's welcome Max Clow to the show. He is the Chief Program Officer at the New Politics Leadership Academy. It's a nonprofit dedicated to recruiting and helping folks engage in civil change to run for a political office. Therein lies some of the optimism we're talking about. And he's the author of this compelling and very timely new book, Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Max Clow, welcome to the show, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. You talk about oh so many important things, and it's a very important topic now as we are living in these very incendiary, polarizing times. A lot of people are despondent about the state of race and the state of what we call otherizing one another. It comes from the top down, as you well know. But there are some things to be optimistic about. We'll talk about that as we get into your life's work. But talk a little bit about your background, how you were drawn to this work of mobilizing social change. As a young kid, you were involved in this. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. And the quest is that I grew, you know, kind of came into the world a straight white guy in a Connecticut suburb, privileged upbringing, and always knew that race was just a very important issue in this country, but also incredibly divisive and controversial. And just always had this sense of I just didn't understand it. I didn't understand how things could happen and people could have such different perspectives and so much disagreement about it. And I really just lived with that question for years of just what is happening? How does this work? And it led, you know, through some work with nonprofits and ultimately to getting a doctorate in education that led to the study that's at the heart of this book and just years of really just how can we understand what's going on in some way that is hopefully helpful. And
understanding is the key. Right. Now you talk about how you stumbled upon, while you were doing your doctorate at Harvard, you stumbled upon this experiment or this exercise at Camp Anytown. Talk about that. It's called the separation exercise. How you stumbled upon that, and tell us a little bit about what it is.
Sure. So I was doing research into youth leadership, trying to understand how different programs taught that. And that is when I went to visit a program called Camp Anytown, which happens all across the country. It's been running for 60 years. And it's a week-long residential program for a very diverse group of high school students. They come together for a week at a camp or retreat center to think about racism and homophobia and xenophobia and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, all of these isms. And it's a powerful program, but there's something that happens on the last day that really changed my life. And what happens was the participants gathered in a circle before breakfast, as they did every day. But on this last day, something really unusual happened. The directors separated them into groups, whites, Asians, Jews, Latinos, LGBTQ, blacks. And they very sternly said, don't talk to other groups and don't make eye contact with members of other groups. And then they went into breakfast, and the white kids went first and had double servings and a big table. And every group kind of lower in the hierarchy had less resources until the black kids were sitting on the floor with very little food. And they call it the separation exercise, and it's very clearly an effort to simulate a kind of hierarchical, segregated Jim Crow-style social system. But what I watched happen between breakfast and lunch was the participants challenged these systems, and you saw events unfold that really looked in really clear ways like events of the real world civil rights movement. And I just realized that here was a chance to study a civil rights movement in a petri dish, basically. So I watched three more of them. I spent the next four years of my life watching three more of them and analyzing them and trying to understand what insights might we gain about how these systems work through this kind of empirical scientific study.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. How were the dynamics that you observed? How were they? Were there certain constants? Like in other words, you observe people realizing that something was wrong here, and some people were outspoken. Did this happen in every time you observed it for the few years that you observed each session?
Yeah, so I watched three of these, and there were definitely patterns across all three. And you know, one of the patterns was at least 2 hours went by with almost nothing happening. So just this long period of kind of stasis and obedience and conformity and people not really challenging the rules. And then in every case, it was somebody from a group lower in the hierarchy, a person of color, was the first to really challenge the system. And they would do something and the system would tip. And after that long period of stasis, you'd get the sudden movement of kind of pretty dramatic transformation in which the system would come together.
Example?
Yeah.
So
the one that kind of mirrored the real world most clearly, there was a member of the Latino group named Eduardo. He tried unsuccessfully to reach out to a couple other groups a couple times, and then he went and went right up to another group and said, "Join me, we have to challenge this." And finally that group said yes, and all of a sudden within 10 minutes you had this formation of this kind of self-organized nonviolent protest movement. They came together and crafted kind of a 10-point value statement and began kind of moving out to other groups to invite them to join this movement. And just this kind of incredible transformation movement that was triggered by this one person's effort to challenge the rules.
Fascinating. So you have to have that one person to spark it. As you said, that's a microcosm of what it is in a real civil rights movement or any movement.
Yeah, and then things start to change really fast. Part of the thing is how do we think about what happens after there is that initial, kind of break of the system.
Fascinating to watch. And this is a culmination of a week of events, so these kids were already kind of comfortable with each other at that point when they were
Yes.
So they were then separated artificially in their mind because they had worked together so well over that period that week. So it was sort of saying, hey, what are we doing and why are we doing it? Were there counselors watching them, instructing them, or they just said, just sit there and do whatever you – just watching them to see what they were doing?
Yeah, so the counselors were told to be parts of the groups that they belong to and to not challenge the rules, to let the participants take the lead. And then the directors were, they called them enforcers. So the directors were the ones who, if a participant started to reach out to another group, said, you have to get back to your group, you're breaking the rules, what are you doing? So that was how the folks in charge managed themselves.
So it's always interesting to see who are the rule breakers out there, right?
Yeah,
the activists and the artists or the rule breakers.
It took a lot of courage.
It takes a lot of courage. It does. Exactly, it does. So you watched this, and this became sort of the fulcrum of a lot of your work beyond that, in the book and some of the other work that you've been doing over the years since then, because this happened in 2002, 2004, something like that, right?
Correct, Chris. So I was doing the research and graduated in 2005, and then I went on to a career in national service. I worked for an amazing organization called City Year, which is an AmeriCorps program, young adults ages 17 to 24 who do a year of full-time service in high-need schools, keeping kids in school and on track to graduate, and just fell in love with the idea of national service. But then there was the events with Michael Brown. There was all these kind of events that were all about race, and I just felt like I thought the findings from this research were important enough. I had to rewrite it as a book and put it out there in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what's your take now? Because we're living, and of course, well, you were working on the book before, but you had, I'm assuming, but we had the Charlottesville situation.
Yeah.
We've had these church bombings.
Absolutely.
Now. We have, of course, the election of Donald Trump to president and all these rallies and the incendiary language, and just that the other day on the cover of the New York Post, inflammatory language headline directed at Representative Omar, who had made some controversial comments, and I, in this show, everybody knows I call it as I see it, and both sides have to be called out, and some of the things she said were irresponsible and reckless, but at the same time, she received a serious death threat. Somebody was arrested in upstate New York for threatening her life, and the same night Donald Trump made some really irresponsible comments to a group of Jewish Americans, and some insulting comments to them, too, but we won't go there. You know, I mean, just on and we go, but I'm just saying...
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot going on, and when you see that... How does this, I mean, and you're working in the trenches, or you have worked in the trenches with people and educating them on these issues. I mean, are you optimistic, pessimistic? I mean, I always say I'm still, even in the Trumpian era, I remain pretty much a glass half full kind of a gal, because I always see there's an opportunity in the resistance movement and more people, not just young kids, but also, you know, those of us who are older, middle-aged people and older people are getting involved and saying, hey, you know, we can't just sit back and let it happen, because this is a really... crisis point, I think, in our country. That doesn't mean we can't do something about it, but we have to have a call to action. So what's your take in the trenches as you are and being in this field for so long? I mean, do you feel more or less optimistic, I guess, is my question.
I mean, one thing I did with the book was try and stare with a very clear eye at how cruel and unjust and unfair these systems are, to understand how they work, but also to see how real the possibility of change is and how progress has happened over time. And, you know, I like to think if I ever get too complacent out of looking at the progress, you got to focus on how much work there is still left to be done. And if you ever start to feel despair at how dark it is and how much, you know, cruelty there still is, you got to spend a little bit of time thinking about how the progress has happened. And that's how I try and hold it right now.
But do you feel like we've taken a couple of steps back? I mean, there's all this underbrush of,
This is one of the things,
I was just going to say, it's sort of like there's been this, what they call the backlash against when President Obama was elected. Some of these people came out from under the rock, and Trump gave them permission to not only come out from under the rock, but, you know, fly their freak flag, basically, and say whatever they want and be out there in droves. And that can be very despairing, I think, to think about. This still exists, and not only does it exist, but it's almost being, it's not... covertly, at least tacitly, approved of by the leadership in this country, and that's pretty scary stuff.
You know, one thing you see when you take the long view of this is how this is a pattern, that any kind of progress around race is followed pretty rapidly by a pretty intense backlash. And it happened after the Civil War, where there was this moment of Reconstruction, where there was all this kind of progress, and you know, black people were stepping into political office and making all this progress, and then you got Jim Crow. And so this is a cycle. And, you know, my background is not as a historian. I'm a developmental psychologist. And this seems to be how development happens, where you take two steps forward and then a step or two steps backwards. And, you know, it's painful to watch, but it does seem to be that this is never a linear process of just moving straight in one direction in an unbroken, you know, line.
Yeah, right. It's like growing pains. But sometimes, unfortunately, sometimes it feels like, you know, one or two steps forward and six or seven steps backwards.
Yeah.
But I think you're right.
Yeah.
There's an interesting, I don't know if you saw it, I haven't really gotten a chance to watch it yet, but I know it's they just premiered it, a series about Reconstruction on PBS, where they do talk about this, what you're talking about, that you know, right after the end of slavery, African Americans were coming into their fore and having these leadership roles, and they were pretty truncated very quickly. So it's very
My hope
problem
is the cycle can move faster.
Yeah, exactly, and we don't always learn from history, because some of us don't, you know. Some of the people in the leadership don't even read history. That's also a problem. I have a question from one of our listeners, Gary, in the popular chat box said, are you afraid that we're moving, the pendulum has swung too far, that political correctness, particularly on college campuses, has made it easier, not harder, to otherize because of things like microaggressions and triggers? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, it's a challenge to engage in these conversations in ways that honors the humanity of the other. And I definitely think we're at this moment where it's just very hard to discuss any of this in ways that are productive. But that is the challenge that we face right now. And I do think it's possible to do it. But we have to find a way to honor the experiences of the others without you know, turning them into the enemy, that they think differently than I do, and therefore I should not engage with them as human beings.
That's so important. I think that is so key, understanding and listening to somebody else and not coming in with preconceived notions is very difficult. I know it's hard, certainly in this era particularly. I mean, I'm definitely a liberal, but I'm also always looking for common ground. But I have to say, I have difficulty. I will listen. I try to listen to people who are Trump supporters. I know we're not supposed to say they're stupid or anything like that, and I don't like to broad brush anybody, and I don't. But I'm having difficulty dealing with some people who can flat out ignore the inhumanity of this administration and the inhumanity of Donald Trump, and the character does matter. It's not just about policy, although some of the policies are outrageous, but something that I never felt, even under like George W. Bush. And my friends always left me. They're like, "Well, you're rewriting history," because I'll say, "Oh, at least Bush wasn't so bad." I'm like, I'm not saying that I thought he was a great president by any stretch,
it was
but
different.
I am saying I don't.
It was definitely
different. He had a sense of humanity about him, and his character does matter. I don't think I ever. I guess I took it for granted because it never occurred to me. Not that these people were ever perfect by any means, even people I supported, but I just didn't assume they would be as deplorable, frankly, to borrow a Hillary term, as Trump himself. Not his supporters necessarily, but he himself is. And I think that's really hard to go into a conversation with somebody and to be as open as I pride myself on being in general. You're right. It's a very tough time to be in, but you have to try to do it, I guess.
I have to say, one of the surprising findings from this research was, you know, I watched three of these exercises. All three of them ended in very different ways. And after careful analysis, it seemed like the what created the difference was the quality of being of the people in charge, of the directors. And it was finding that the kind of inner way of being of the folks in authority created kind of a social field that influenced the whole system. And I think, you know, what we're seeing now is how the president does that. And, you know, with Trump, we're seeing he's calling forth that it's okay for this kind of racism and xenophobia and Islamophobia suddenly called forth in the system. And it's kind of a reflection of his way of being. And that is what you saw in these systems was in some way I don't fully understand, but the inner life of people calls forth dynamics in the world around them.
Fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit more specifically about some of those differences in terms of the outcomes? Because we didn't talk about the outcomes of it. You just said they had stirrings.
Yeah,
patterns.
You know, again, there were some patterns that appeared across all three of them. But when I started the research, I kind of figured they would all roughly go in the same, you know, way, and that's not what happened at all. They all unfolded in very different ways. And, you know, one of them, there was a director who was this strange mix of kind of dictatorial and disengaged. So she did not share power with anybody. She just said, I'm the only one in charge. I'm the only one doing anything. And then she kind of set this thing up and sat in a cabin and just let it run. And she was not particularly engaged. And the system just kind of fizzled. Like, not a whole lot happened in that. And then there was another one where there were actually two directors. They shared a lot of power, really empowered the staff and made sure everybody felt deeply engaged in kind of their role in this work. And then they were absolutely out there kind of playing their roles as enforcers. And that was when you saw this incredible kind of self-organizing, nonviolent protest movement emerge. And it was something about the way the director showed up that created this field where that kind of change was possible. And it's something I've thought a lot about, seeing, you know, with the different, you know, when a new president steps in, what starts emerging in the system. And the key insight is the interconnectedness of our inner way of being and the world around us. And, you know, not all of us can be president, but all of us influence the world around us and the organizations we're in, the people we're connected to. And it speaks to the importance of doing some reflection and doing some inner work as part of the process of trying to confront these systems.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's all about, you're right, how you interact and being comfortable in your own skin and knowing your own self and your own goals and your missions. I'm also, you know, a trained therapist, so I have some of those, that background there. But interacting with the world, and listening to people and what your particular role may be. I'm curious as to if those people that were doing it, if it was just their particular style, or did they do it deliberately? I mean, was the dictatorial person doing it deliberately to watch what would happen if she just said, or was that just the way she was?
No,
really
I think
know.
It's the I spent enough time with these folks. It's who they were. It was kind of how their way of being in the world, and it goes deeper than a particular interaction, and it's really kind of a quality of presence that infuses the system, and it really speaks to that. You know, if we care about these injustices in the world around us, we do have to begin by turning inwards at some point and kind of interrogating our assumptions and working on our own character and trying to awaken to a higher consciousness of how all this works. Because without that kind of inner work, we just reproduce these systems that we claim to want to end.
Yeah. And then how to bring it outward and, you know, bring your own sensibility to whatever, as you said, whatever group you're in. I mean, it seems insurmountable when you say, obviously, not everybody can be president, but everybody can make a contribution in some way, I guess.
And everybody is plugged into this network of interdependence and influencing the systems around them, you know, the organizations, the families, the communities. And, you know, that's all we get to do is kind of influence the folks in our orbit. And so are we kind of showing up and doing the work ourselves and not just hoping somebody else is going to handle it, or thinking that the work is just around us and not within us.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. What is your take now? Because since you started this work or this research back in 2002, 2004, things have changed in terms of the landscape of the way we do connect with people, social media in particular. That's something which there are pros and cons to it, good things, not such good things. What is your take on that, and what's that has – does it help or hinder, I guess, or both?
You know, one thing I learned from studying systems is you get this very counterintuitive both and. So it both helps and hinders. We have more insight into the inner lives of other people than we probably have ever had. And it also makes it easier for us to find our own kind of bubble and listen to people just like us. And so it's a bit of a double-edged sword. I will say one thing I hope with this book is to kind of pull us out of the headlines and the short-term thinking, to view this as a process that's really been unfolding over all of human history, and to understand it in a deeper way that goes beyond just how do we react to what happened yesterday.
That's a tall order, Max, but I hope. But I'm on your page on that. But it's so hard now because people expect. I mean, our attention span, our cultural attention span, is so much less than it ever has been. Everything's clickbait and people are roaming, you know, your head is spinning with social media. Sometimes I say it's good to disconnect, or the new thing. They used to talk about FOMO, fear of missing out. Now it's JOMO, joy of missing out. Sometimes just take a step or 20 away and just enjoy your life. Don't just do things so you can post it on social media. I mean, it's crazy that what people get caught up in. But it's really important work, and you sound like you're not completely pessimistic. You're clear-eyed about it, as you said, and you know there's a lot of work to be done, but you do think that progress is on a good track.
I do think there's pathways to transform this stuff at the personal level, at the societal level. There's a lot of people waking up to really wanting to just not be stuck in this endless cycle, you know, but one thing I'm clear of is everybody, all you get to do is make your own personal choice and not spend your days in despair about what other people are doing, or like everybody gets to wake up. All you get to control is yourself. Are you going to take kind of a journey of personal awakening around this to understand it more deeply and to step into whatever power you have to move things in a more positive direction? And I do believe everybody can do that. And I invite anybody listening to this to, you know, what's your edge, your uncomfortable edge around this work, and step into that and not spend your days, you know, totally focused on what other people are doing around this.
That's a great way to do it. Get out of your comfort zone a little bit, get a little uncomfortable, and find some answers within, and then try to find some answers beyond yourself. It's great.
Right.
The book is
right.
Race and Social Change, A Quest to Study, A Call to Action. Max Clow is the author. He's been doing this work for years, so congratulations on both the book and your life's work, which is very important. And folks can find out more. We're going to certainly post the podcast when it becomes available and details about your book as your at your website, right, maxclow.com. Is that right?
You got it. Thank you very much. Yes.
Hey, Max, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Great conversation.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Max Clow, as I said, we'll post it all for you. Details on his connection as well as the podcast when it becomes available. This is the Annabeth Erkley Show. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Begin. Back streets of America.
going down. For what it's worth, Staples Singers for Ollie on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Thank you for your kind words via the PopNet chat box. Happy to have you tagging along. And Tracy Chapman across the lines as we sort of take on this very weighty subject of race and social change. Thanks again to Max Clow, the author of the compelling, timely book, Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Details at his website, Max Clow, that's Max, K-A-K-L-A-W-A-U.com. Max Clow.com. I'll post it for you along with the podcast when it becomes available. Don't forget, all the shows are archived as such. Follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show wherever you get your podcast, from Mixcloud to Stitcher, iTunes to NetNow. You can find it. Select editions, too, on the Arts Radio Network and PopNet, also on New York Talk Radio. Lots of outlets chiming in, and we are very happy about that. Indeed, we are. So have at us. The cultural cacophony this week has been crazy, I know. You got lots to say about it. Twitter is open at AB Writes 24/7. Listening live on April 12th, you can join us via the phone line at 347-85. And we also have the PopNet chat box and the Facebook page open. So have at us, whatever way works for you, as we like to say. Join us on Twitter, on the PopNet chat box. Leandra says, very compelling conversation, thank you, but I can't be as optimistic as you and Max seem to be. I am so concerned about the circular firing squad that I fear the Democrats will be engaging in 2020. Too many candidates, and you know they're going to eat each other alive, and Trump will come out the victor. I am so concerned about that. Well, let's not assume it's going to happen, but it could happen, and I think we have to keep our eyes on the prize, as they say. I'm blue no matter who. We can have a vigorous primary without eviscerating each other. I hope that's true. We do have to whittle down the field of candidates at some point, but we are a long way. And remember in 2015 when Scott Walker and Jeb Bush were the front runners. So people are already talking polls, and you know I detest the polls because the polls were part of what did Hillary in 2016. But we still have to be optimistic. I always say let's try to be as optimistic as we can. But having said that, we have to be realistic about it, and we have to realize where it can go and how serious this is. So please be careful about that. I was punked yesterday by one of my friends who I call the geezers at Starbucks, a guy who I respect. I still respect him. He claims he was kidding at the end, but I'm not so sure. He told me he might have to vote for Trump if the Democrats put up somebody like Bernie Sanders. This is a wealthy guy. He's a smart man. He's a retired attorney. He's a person who previously has said he detested Donald Trump, but now he's thinking about voting for Donald Trump. He says, then later he told me he would never vote for Donald Trump, but he is concerned about the way the Democrats are heading. We've got to come up with a good candidate, good consensus candidate, but I think just like in 2016, people can't be there are a lot of people, let's put it this way, a lot of people on the right side of the aisle who held their nose and voted for Donald Trump to advance their agenda, and all of us on the left side, as I've said this before, mock them or critical of them, et cetera, but they got what they wanted. They stacked the courts already for a generation that will be impacting your kids and grandkids, perhaps. Certainly your kids. I don't know how old everybody is who's listening, but yeah. It's going to be at least a generational situation because as incompetent as they have been in terms of retaining and appointing people, they've managed to stack the courts, and that's partly because that was Mitch McConnell's agenda, so it's not just Donald Trump's. They've done that already, and that's why they're now talking about stacking or redesigning the Supreme Court and expanding it. I'm not so sure I agree with that, but maybe we have to because we're going to be in for a big conservative shift. But part of it is because we took the eyes off the prize and people couldn't see past the fact that Bernie was gypped, that we have the purity test on the left side. So we really have to work on that. But if Bernie gets the nomination, as opposed to this guy who now at the end of the conversation claimed he was just pranking me just to get me upset, I'll take it, you know, trust but verify, as I say. I'll take it under advisement, but my estimation has shifted a little bit. That's on me. As I've said, I have a hard time dealing with people who will ignore Trump's flaws to get their own ends, whatever they may be, whether they're financial, whether they're social, whatever it is, you have to say at what point do you draw the line. And I have drawn the line a long time ago, and I can't imagine other people not doing it. I also don't get – the point is his supporters, his hardcore supporters will still be with him, and they're going to vote. I mean, they did a whole thing on the taxes and how people are impacted negatively by his quote-unquote middle-class tax break, which we know just didn't really benefit the middle class. And they interviewed some people who were getting lesser refunds than they expected or they had gotten in the past or actually had to pay taxes. And one woman said, yes, I'm getting $2,000 less than I expected or that I got last year. She said that Donald Trump doesn't understand where they're coming from. He doesn't want to show his taxes because he probably didn't pay any tax. But guess what? She's still voting for him. She still supports him. So go figure that one out. I can't. You know, it just, it's mind, you know, your head just spins when you start thinking about how people do that. So my point here is these people are there. They're out there, and they will vote for him. So on the blue side, we have to be blue no matter who. So we can't eviscerate each other. And I hear what Leandra is saying, but we can't be that despondent. We have to mobilize, and we have to, you know, as Max instructed us, look inward to what we want and what we're about. And how then can we influence other people in a positive way? To, yes, vote for who you want to vote for in the primary. I'm all for that. I have many times have voted for the person who didn't wind up getting the nomination, but I quickly pivoted to who I thought would be what we call next best, and that's what I said during 2016. I mean, there's not – it's beyond the lesser of two evils at this point. There are real differences, real substantial differences, and I will take any one of those 20-some – it seems like 20,000, but 20 or whatever candidates they are over Donald Trump without knowing anything else about them. But, yes, I'm sure there are those that I would find more preferable than others. But we have to work and at some point work together on that. And that's the collective, the inward to the outward, the collective we have to work on. Your tech, Twitter is AB Rights, phone line 347-857-4505. I know I went on and on, so let's check out Twitter, shall we? a lot of people chiming in about, a couple of other people. Nixie says, hey, great conversation, lots to think about indeed. Sammy says, good stuff, and as always, AB, thanks for the conversation. But it's a tough one. It is a tough one indeed. Other folks are chiming in about the Bill Barr hearings, and what else do we expect? He's nothing but a toady, so says Jermaine. We knew it all along. He auditioned for the gig. John says it's clear that Mueller believes DOJ policy. The president can't be indicted, but he did say he couldn't exonerate him. Congress must now impeach. But Barr believes Prez can't commit any crime, and that's how he got the effing job. I don't know. And, of course, this whole thing about his using the word spying. And it's funny to me, I did see part of that hearing the other day when he said that there was some spying in the Trump campaign or he was looking into it. And he has some basis to believe there was spying. And he said it a couple of times, and then it was Brian Schatz, who's the senator from Hawaii, who is a Democrat, who came out and said, I want you to clarify. I want to give you the chance to clarify. And then he did use the word surveillance, but still didn't particularly waver on it. Now, you know, the problem is, and somebody else told me the other day, well, maybe there is spying. And there might have been, and they should have looked into it, but they have looked into it. I shouldn't say they should have looked into it. They already have looked into it and determined that it wasn't the case, but investigate away. I'm not saying they shouldn't investigate that, but let's see what the Mueller report has to say about what was going on in the Trump campaign. The truth is probably John Kennedy, who is the Republican senator from Louisiana, who I don't at all agree with, I don't think, except he's a very talented and amusing speaker. He's a good orator. He has good witticisms and commentary. He can be very funny. But he does sometimes, he has a little bit of a spine, not always, but he does. I mean, he's turned down one of the most horrific judges or judge candidates that came through who had no qualifications whatsoever, and he pretty much shut him down and said, I can't vote for this guy. So he's not a complete party line toady. But he did say there was probably spying in both campaigns, and there probably were. So let's look into it. I'm okay with looking into it, but when you use the word spying, the connotation there, and, of course, just the fact that Trump gloms onto this and uses it to advance his narrative, and that's part of the problem. The Barr, quote-unquote, summary memo or letter with the no cause for charges, no cause, there was no guilt, not guilty, proclaiming him not guilty even though Mueller couldn't do that when it came to obstruction. And, of course, Mueller did exonerate him, I guess, in terms of the actual criminal conspiracy charge that would hold up in court, but did not. The report, being close to 400 pages, must have a lot of things that are uncomplimentary because he's so concerned about it, getting that narrative out that I'm completely exonerated, which was not true, and I won. That's his thing. I don't care about the Mueller report. I won. That's what he said. Of course he doesn't care. It's 300 pages. He's not going to read it. Number one. And number two, he just wants bottom lines. And when we get the redacted version of this thing next week or whenever it's coming, let's see how redacted it's going to be. I mean, that's the question. He's color-coding the redaction. So we're going to have yellow coding for things that are grand jury testimony and purple for something else. And there's like four categories. What's going to be left? You know, a couple of names? It's just, it's crazy. One constitutional expert was on television yesterday, and she said, I think if I had to guess, about 60% will be redacted. That's a lot. We're going to get very little in this report, and they're going to try to hold it out as long as possible. It's ironic that the day they arrested Julian Assange in England for extradition, we're fighting about this because it would be funny if WikiLeaks got their hands on the Mueller report and they just dumped it into the world. world than Donald Trump would have a different view of WikiLeaks, which he already is changing. First, you know, during the campaign, he loved WikiLeaks. They have so many quotes of him saying, because WikiLeaks was exposing all these emails from Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, et cetera, the DNC. Yesterday when they asked him, he says, yeah, I heard something about Julian Assange. It's up for the attorney general to deal with, and he's doing an excellent job, by the way. Of course he is. He's doing your bidding. He's your white crow, and you were looking for one, and you got it. And then he went on to say, I don't know about WikiLeaks. It's not my life's deal. Or it's not my deal in life. It was your deal in life for a while, that's for sure. That's the thing with Trump. When it works for him, he's all on that train. But as soon as it doesn't, he's thrown you under that bus and rode over it two or three times without even thinking about it. So I don't know why these people like Bill Barr, in the twilight of his career, this is a guy who was already attorney general once. He supposedly, I don't know much about him, but has a respected career, conservative circles perhaps, but still a respected career as an attorney. Why do you need to sell yourself down the road here to be a toady, essentially, a stooge for President Trump? I don't get it. If somebody gets it, please let me know. Twitter is AB Wright's phone line, 347-857-4505. And yes, we do have the Facebook page and the PopNet checkbox. KP says, listening to Barr on TV and noticed that the white congressmen with southern accents are all POSs and all Republicans, but then again, I repeat myself. See, this is where we get into the other rising thing where people are getting too inflammatory. We got to get out of our echo chambers and listen to it. And that's why I always say, I mean, I appreciate it when the Trumpians call in or write in or tweet in. I don't mind that. I just want people to tell me why they're defending it, because it does, you can be a Republican. And the people I respect a lot are the Republicans who've jumped ship. But notice most of them are not in office. They're pundits or they're people that got kicked out of office or were afraid they would be primaried. See, this is the problem, too, with the Democrats. We have to be careful about this. They always say the most extreme ends of the parties vote during the primaries. So you get that's how you get people are worried about being primaried, because the moderates can't pull it off. Well, guess what? It's up to all of us to get out there and vote, not just if you're an extreme part of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. If you have a view that's more moderate, get out there and vote during primary day, because if you're concerned about Bernie Sanders, say, and again, if you are a Bernie Sanders supporter, vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary. I don't have any problem with that. And if Bernie Sanders got the nomination, I would vote for him in a heartbeat over Trump. There's no question about it. But he would not be my choice for a number of reasons, and we've talked about it before, not the least of which is he's not a Democrat. But refuses to join the party. That's kind of sticks in my craw a little bit. But be that as it may, if he gets the nomination, I'm voting for him, of course. I mean, because I'm blue no matter who. And I think that in the past, people have seen that and been that way. But now some people on our side of the aisle are not doing that. And you got to be careful about it. And you've got to get out there. But you have to get out there early. Get out there and mobilize for the candidate that you do want to support. I really don't know who I want to support yet. I mean, winning is going to be a big factor, because we have to change this shift. We have to make the pivot away from Trump. And there are several people who impress me. There's some not as much, but they all impress me more than him, that's for sure. And that's my take on it. So, I want to be open to other people's views. But it's infuriating. I mean, I'm agreeing with you, KP. I'm not denigrating you. I'm just saying sometimes the anger that we have, and I see it in myself too, it's hard for me to tamp it down and to be open-minded. If you have a constructive conversation, though, you might find more common ground than you know. Like I think I've spoken about the gentleman that painted my living room last fall. He said he was a Trump supporter. At first, I thought he was joking, and then he came in, and I said, well, why do you support him? He was an immigrant, legal immigrant, been here since the early 70s, I think, from Hungary. And that country went through changes where it was a communist dictatorship, then they had democracy, now they're going back again. So he's very against the autocratic end of things. But his first response was his business is doing better under Trump. So I'm like, okay, you're answering the question that's why you like him. But then as we were talking, and he watched a lot of Fox News, because he had a lot of the Fox News parroting points about the kids in cages, oh, it's like summer camp, all that kind of nonsense that you know is coming out of. I always say to my Trumpian people that I know that are on the Trumpian bandwagon, you're back on the pipe, aren't you? You know, you're smoking that Fox News. But when we had this conversation, this guy was very concerned about the Constitution, and then because he's very interested in democracy, since he came from a system that wasn't like that. Well, you got to look at his autocratic tendencies, and he was looking at it, and we had these interesting conversations, and he said, you know, you're right, because certain things might be good, but certain things are not so good, and they can go too far, and I've seen it go too far. So you can have constructive conversations with people, and people can differ. It's just, again, the thing with Trump for me is not about policies. I mean, there's some of the policies are bad, but what's bad is that people are, to me, what has become a deal breaker is that for people to support him, you have to discard so much hatefulness, you know, in terms of rhetoric, in terms of deeds, in terms of the way he deals with people, just his criminality, the fact that he's a thief, the fact that he's a compulsive liar. I mean, all these things are things that you have to discard. So there's a character, you know, questions of character that are there. And I just think it'll be a very low bar, no pun intended, for the AG, for whoever gets in, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, next, because there'll be some return to normalcy and some return to common decency and humanity, which we all have to find. And that goes beyond party lines and policy. And that's an awakening for me, too, not to be so partisan. Not really an awakening, because I've always tried to look for common ground, but even in terms of just taking certain things for granted. Don't take that for granted ever again. And I don't know how people pull the lever for Trump. I know people don't like Hillary, all that stuff, but putting them on the side by side on the same playing field, it just doesn't make sense to me. That's me. What's your take? Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Deborah says, wow, Barr definitely showed that the report to the White House would be the report would go to the White House in a different way than it will go to Congress and to the American people. We ain't going to see much. yeah, I don't know, but somebody will leak it. One of those Trumpians who writes anonymous letters, you never know. It'll be a backstabber. Reach out, Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Facebook page, Batman Chat Box, number 2. Amy Beth Arquisha. Minded Trumpian backstabbers to release the Mueller report in toto. You never know. It's the OJs on the Amy Beth Arquisha Show for Claire. Thanks for chiming in. As folks are taking on the cultural cacophony, it's all its myriad stains. Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. Yes, the Facebook page and the PopNet chat box are open as well. Vinny on PopNet chat box. Hey, love the show, AB. Enjoying listening to it live. Liked your conversation. I, too, though, am not as optimistic as you guys seem to be. We got a long way to go, and we're taking several steps back, if you know what I'm saying. I hear you, Vinny, but we got to push ahead, and part of it is taking a look inward and seeing what you can do to move things forward and make things better, just day at a time, one day at a time, as I say. Indeed. Unfortunately, another stain on the Trump administration takes place today. The transgender ban went into effect in the military, and this thing kind of came out of left field because I guess he was egged on by somebody. Who knows what the heck happened? I mean, during the election, he acted as if he was going to be a Republican ally for the LGBTQ community. Not so much. So who knows? But it's in effect, and it affects a lot of people, and it's just horrible. Jason on Twitter says, all our lives we tell our children, be who you are, but the deplorable, inhumane transgender ban contradicts that advice. These brave men and women want to fight for our country that they love. Gender identity politics should not prevent that. This is a dark day in America. So well said, Jason. Heavy-handed maybe, but well said. Especially when you think about the fact that the so-called commander-in-chief, I shouldn't say so-called, he is, Donald Trump, you know, got out of military service with those dubious bone spurs 4 or 5 times. He avoided it, and yet now he is discriminating against a lot of people. I think it's like 15,000, they said. I was surprised at the number of active transgender. Now, they won't all be affected if they've already been officially, it's confusing, but if you've officially been designated, recognized as a transgender, and you're already in the service, but those who are now first applying for it won't be able to do it. So some people are grandfathered in, I think, is what I understand. But still, it's just, what's the point of it? I mean, the people that were engaged in it have been doing their service to this country selflessly for years and decades in some cases. It's been fine. I mean, this is sort of like, now we're going to go back to the don't ask, don't tell, which worked up to a point, and then once that was eradicated, again, gay people in the military seem to be working out just fine, as it was when they didn't have women and they didn't have blacks and all that. I mean, you know, moving forward. So what happened? I don't know. Jessica posts a quote from Martin Luther King, in the end we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. That is a good point, underscoring a lot of things we talked about in this show. We have to get out there and speak up, and it's incumbent upon all of us, not just kids learning in school, but everybody, part of the resistance and doing what we can to make our consternation known, if you know what I'm saying. So get out there and do it. And a lot of the ways you can do it if you're an artist is through your creativity, and that's why the Inspiration to Action Challenge comes in. As an artist, you know, you can do things sometimes in fiction and in drama that you can't say, and in visual arts too, and music, of course, that sometimes seem too strident or polemic or divisive if you just spew it in a oratory sense. So sometimes you got to sneak things in. Spread the word that way, and that works sometimes too as well. So I'm always gratified when the Inspiration Action Challenge has spurred some folks on to connect or reconnect with their own inner creative artist. Today it is Casey, who is in Melbourne, Florida, and she says, I am embarking on new creative endeavors, more time on my hands thanks to a layoff, but it's all for the good. Glad you said that, Casey. Writing, ceramics, painting, and I am exploring some theater opportunities too. Really enjoying it. And the challenge that you got me going on about a year ago with your show and your inspirational interviews and advice have worked to help me get into a new place. So thank you so much. Hey, thank you, Casey. I appreciate the heartfelt comments. Keep going. I'm glad you said sometimes things, even if it wasn't your choice, somebody made the choice for you. You might be angry at first or disheartened, but sometimes it's all for the good, as you said. You never know. There's always that silver lining. Embrace it and go for it, and congratulations. Keep us posted, please. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Show has worked for you, or if you need a little creative kick in the keister, let's have a creativity coaching counseling conversation. The first one's on me. Either way, reach out via the website. It's AmyBethArkawy, ArkAwy.com. Easy access via the Twitter feed, or just Google us and you'll find us. And we will, if you need a little conversation, we'll connect in about 2 or 3 weeks, okay? And while you're there, you can peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon Mystery, some other goodies up for grabs. Chime in, too, with your big story, Forgotten 45, and guest suggestions while you're there. Some good guests coming up in the future, including Lorraine Devon Wilkie is back. She's an author speaking about weaving interesting things into fiction and talking about race relations. There's an intriguing book out there called The Alchemy of Noise. I'm just reading it now. I think you'll enjoy it. She's been on before. She's also a singer-songwriter, so we'll have a lot to talk about. She's got a lot to say about a lot of things on politics, as we all do these days. So I can't wait for that conversation. And I'd love to talk to you, too. Twitter is AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. We're almost ready to sashay out of here, though, aren't we? I guess we are. It's been a long while. We had Max on, so that was great. Thanks again to Max Clow. Fascinating book, and I am urging you to take a peek at it, especially if you're interested in social change, and who the heck isn't these days. It's called Race and Social Change, A Quest to Study, A Call to Action. MaxClow.com, MaxKlau.com. I got it. We will post it for you along with the podcast when it becomes available. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for playing with us in real time. Always love it. I mean, I love the podcast system, too, because you can listen when it's convenient for you. But when you interact with us while we're doing the show, it makes it even more exciting and fun for all of us. Hey, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML headquarters, the TCS crew, thank you so much. Don't forget tomorrow. It's Record Store Day. We may have something surprising for you to be on the lookout on social media. We will post all the details for you there. So have yourself a great weekend. Whatever you do, wherever you go, please drive safe. Play nice, dream big, and come back and see us, won't you? Maybe that's the show. Take care. I love you all.